Now, of course, they're talking about a romantic problem, and I'm using it to illustrate the love-hate relationship we have with politics. That's the legendary Ray Charles and Norah Jones with "Here We Go Again." It's from Ray Charles's acclaimed album, Genius Loves Company, released in 2004, the year he died at the age of 73. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we are revisiting this question about the debate. I call it the Q&A session, but from a different perspective this time. And as the industry is seeing it, now, as the industry sees it, this was great. A record 15 million people tuned in for the Q&A in Las Vegas, hosted by CNN and Facebook. And what was significant to the industry? They go by the numbers. This was big business according to the industry. This is exactly what I'm telling you. And here we have several reports basically discussing the debates, having nothing to do at all with the content of the debates, as they call them, but having to do with the business of it. I'll give you this example from Reuters. Reuters is reporting that Nielsen confirmed that the 15.3 million viewers who watched it was smaller than the 24 million and the 22.9 million viewers who watched the first two Republican debates that were shown on Fox News. So they setting up this dynamic saying, well, here's how we see it. This is how we see it. Now, the last time that CNN, according to Reuters, had a major audience share of this type was in 2008 when Barack Obama squared off against Hillary Clinton. But here's what it says. CNN charged advertisers $100,000 for a 30-second ad appearing during the course of the Q&A session, compared with $200,000 for the Republican debates in September. And typically, at prime time, CNN would charge between $4,000 and $6,000 for the same type of ad, for an ad in prime time. Now, you understand how they're reporting this. We haven't touched it, just talking about the numbers and the business end of it. So that we see here an understanding in a part of the world that we very seldom consider when we're talking politics, the business of politics. It is huge. And that is why CNN did such a huge thing, made such a big effort, and going to this opulent place to stage this production, which is what it was a production. And if you disagree with that characterization, I will read you from CNN's own reporter who writes about money. And this was an article filed today, Brian Stelter writing about the quote debate unquote. And this is what he says. Now, this is CNN's own guy. And he's writing about money, okay? Not about politics, but about money. He said that here, I'll read you the excerpt of the article. Primary debates at this point in past election cycles have averaged 2 to 5 million viewers, but there's something special about this election, something that has a lot more viewers paying attention. Heading into Tuesday night, there was unanimous agreement, he's talking about CNN now, that the total audience would be lower than the 25 million who tuned in for Fox's Republican debate on August 6th. That debate, fueled by Donald Trump, shattered all previous primary debate records. CNN executives expected the ratings would be far lower on Tuesday night. They cautioned ahead of time that Republican and Democratic debates were apples and oranges. For comparison's sake, he says that the Democratic debate record set in 2008 was a mere 10.7 million viewers. And that was a big deal at the time, but compared to the number of people watching this time, it was a mere 10.7 million. So what was this all about? How and why did this happen, this windfall? He talks about it in terms of numbers. 980,000 concurrent live streams, and this means that nearly 1 million homes were watching simultaneously. He talks about the impressive numbers that CNN garnered. And why is this such an important thing? Yes, it says that CNN did a good job. But it is not saying that there was a lot riding on this for CNN, which has been lagging for years behind Fox. Fox is just the king of the hill. Fox owns cable news, and it has done a spectacular job of generating revenues. CNN, according to an article, reporting on its precipitous decline in advertising. This is in the Huffington Post, wrote an article, published an article about CNN's stunning, is the word they used in the headline, stunning advertising drop. They were reported that CNN had lost about 37% of its audience over the past 6 years. And therefore, they had to begin a process of trying to climb back to some degree of credibility. And so this debate, I hate using the word, I call it the Q&A. The Q&A is one of the major sources of revenue for CNN and the industry generally. The media industry depends on political advertising like you would not believe, because this is when they make their money. In fact, you may recall that even Donald Trump, when the in September 16th, on September 16th, when CNN was broadcasting that Q&A session with the Republicans, Trump had said, look, you guys should donate your advertising revenue to veterans. He called them out. You guys should donate that money since it's all for public service and everything. But, you know, of course, this is really what is driving the carefully choreographed, quote, coverage, unquote, of this election cycle. CNN is still reeling from advertising revenue loss. It's got to pay big money to its stars, unquote, including Anderson Cooper, who pulls in a very hefty multi-million dollar salary. And it's declining in audience share. Fox News has just obliterated the field. Fox News is the reigning king, and it has been the reigning king for several years, at least 7 years now. CNN, losing audience. Therefore, not able to say to advertisers, not able to make a case to advertisers that they are making an efficient buy when they buy advertising on CNN, because how many people are watching or listening to CNN? When you lose about 37% of your audience in 6 years, you're coming to the process in a very vulnerable position. And that is why, if you have all this money to make up for, you have all these new people to bring back into the fold, into your market, you've got to play all kinds of ball. And that's what CNN has been doing. Everybody else does it, you know, in print and electronic and media and so forth. They all play the game. But I wanted to bring this to your attention again to underscore the point that you have to be extra vigilant here, because there is another agenda at work that will impact how these things are covered. And for CNN, it had a huge, huge stake in the outcome of the coverage. In fact, CNN's guy, the guy's reporting on money, calls it a show. And that's what it is. They have decided that they're in show business. Your need to know and the media's privilege under its licensing to fulfill an obligation to provide information to the public is secondary. These things are secondary. Number one is it's got to survive. And advertising is the way they go. So Donald Trump is important in all of this because, as I've said, Donald Trump and his outrageous and outlandish and racist behavior, which has garnered, quote, coverage, unquote, but what Donald Trump has actually done and how they have used Donald Trump is leverage against other candidates. We're giving Donald Trump a lot of coverage for free, and he has said so. Donald Trump has said he couldn't even begin to pay for the amount of money, and he's claiming this as one of his the points of that prove how smart he is. By getting all of this coverage for free. But what CNN is doing and what the other organizations, media organizations are doing, is that by covering, providing a particular kind of coverage of Trump and the frequency of coverage, and it is all, you know, Donald Trump burps and it becomes a headline. There's no reason. It's as if nobody in the newsroom knows what a story is. He just gets coverage every day, several times a day. And he has now become his own publisher. He has taken to Twitter and is now in charge of his own media, essentially. But Donald Trump has been a very wonderful asset here, in that because he's so irritating and outlandish and outrageous, and they're covering it as legitimate news, it will stoke the fires of other candidates to open up their purses and take out the advertising dollars. And let's get that going. So Donald Trump is being used by CNN in particular, because CNN has been so slavish and so just, it's embarrassing. An absolute, Paul Craig Roberts calls them prostitutes. They just are at his service. They are extensions of his political campaign. And the hope here is that Trump himself will start spending big money, because we know that an estimated $5 billion would be spent, but that it would agitate other candidates who want to get coverage to buy it. And that's the game. Now, you're right to know about legitimate things, about what's going on in these campaigns and so forth. That's nothing. That really is incidental. CNN understands it is a show, as Fox News understands. They understand this. This is where they're making their money. And it will not come around again for another 4 years. Not this kind of money. So people are now told that, we have a great debate coming up. And you know, they started pumping this thing. They put a lot of effort and energy into marketing, so that you you are conditioned to expect something dramatic to happen. You actually expect a debate. You're not going to get one. They commandeered that process a long time ago. They took that away and commodified it a long time ago. The media see themselves as having no obligation whatsoever to actually informing the public about what the issues are. They see this as just money. Money is big money. And whether it's radio or television or cable or even new media, everybody's looking for a chunk of that. And it is, in fact, and the media will have to own up to it, this is pay-to-play media style. You want coverage? You're going to pay for it. But in the meantime, what is the quid pro quo? The quid pro quo is you get a very elaborate production. You get our best reporters giving you legitimacy. You get airtime for free. You get all this stuff, all this coverage, as if what you're doing is actually worthy of coverage. You're not going to get anything that would cause embarrassment to you. We're not going to attack you. We're going to lay low. We're going to give you all the elastic you need. But at some point, when we sit across the table from each other, we will be talking about what percentage of your multi-million dollar, in the case of Hillary Clinton, she is on course to raise $2.5 billion in this campaign. She's already placed, as you heard right here on this program, she's already placed 5,500 ads. So this is what is driving the public's right to know, as defined by CNN and Fox News and New York Times and the big folks wanting their chunk of big money. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll hear an entirely different view about what's going on in Syria right after this.
She'll break my heart again. I'll play the part again. One more time. All right, Mr. Preston. I've been there before. You know what? I'll try it again.
You're listening to PRN.FM, and you're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. Well, as you know, the situation in Syria is escalating literally from minute to minute toward a point that everybody fears will come to just out-and-out war. And we know that in recent weeks, in the last 2 weeks, a key development is causing a great deal of concern internationally, and that is the intervention by Russia at the invitation of President Bashar Hafez al-Assad, has begun airstrikes in Syria, principally aimed at ISIS, but now people are contending it is really aimed at the U.S.-supported rebels. And then we have, on the flip side of that, the United States entering militarily in this fast deteriorating situation, dropping 50 tons of ammunition and military supplies to the rebels. We've had near skirmishes occurring. There's a question about the no-fly zone and so forth. So the situation is really deteriorating. It is important sometimes to see how our view on the outside squares with the view on the inside. Meaning, how do military people see this? Because we have a general view, I think, in the public, we have a general view of what the United States is doing there. And we've had this discussion on this program. What is the guiding philosophy here? What is the rationale for being in Syria at all? So I was able to talk with Wesley Clark, retired U.S. Army general, retired chairman of the NATO Strategic Command. And we were able to talk. He was on his way, so you would hear a little distortion throughout the interview. He was literally driving to another location as he was talking with me. But I had a chance to ask him about this. What is the thinking and drawing on his military experience? And this is what he said. Thank you, General Clark, for being with us today on Lead Stories.
Pleasure to be with you.
2 weeks ago, President Vladimir Putin began airstrikes in Syria. It was Russia's contribution, he said, to the fight against terrorism, which, quote, he said, is dangerous for the United States, for Russia, and for the European countries, and for the whole world. This week, the United States military planes under escort aircraft dropped 50 tons of ammunition to rebel forces within Syria. U.S. Senator John McCain, chairman of the Armed Services Committee, says that this is a proxy war. Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, I don't think it's a proxy war, but I do think the United States has to develop, articulate, and implement a strategy to preserve our influence in the region and to reassure our European allies that we can deal effectively through NATO with the refugee crisis and with other challenges to European security. We don't want to surrender that role to Russia because it's not in their interest nor in our interest to have Vladimir Putin become the arbiter of European security or Middle Eastern security.
Well, that puts us smack in the middle of what has consistently been the U.S. position, which is it's either or and never, very often, never both. Why is it that we don't get to the point of understanding beyond the immediate situation, understanding and respecting the causes of these things? These things don't happen just out of nowhere. There is a history to them. And do you link at all the current crisis to the utter failure of U.S. as a logical and forward-thinking U.S. foreign policy in the region?
Well, I think that the real failure of U.S. foreign policy was the invasion of Iraq in 2003. It was a catastrophic strategic mistake, probably the worst mistake the United States has ever made in foreign policy. Why? It was a mistake because we didn't know what would follow Saddam Hussein. We didn't have a plan. We hadn't worked it through the details. And when we tried to work through the details, it all fell apart. We opened the door to a titanic struggle in the region between Iranian power and Saudi and Turkish power. And it's a kind of a three-cornered struggle. Of course, you hear a lot about Sunni and Shiism, but the Sunni and Shia sects, that's the manifestation of the struggle. Each side mobilizes its most zealous adherents as a sacrificial pawns in this geostrategic conflict. And so that's what you have going on in the region right now, and the United States is smack in the middle of it because we have historically sided with Saudi Arabia. They've helped assure stability of the world supply of oil. They've been in the background in our support of Jordan and our friendship with Israel. And on the other hand, Iran hasn't. Iran has been in the equivalent of a 35-year war against the United States by proxy, a terrorist campaign, a strike here and there, attacks on our friends. And so the negotiation of this nuclear agreement, it hasn't ended that. If anything, it's perpetuated it and emboldened Iran. And, of course, when we took Saddam Hussein out of Iraq, we opened the door for Iranian influence in there. They came in because during the Iran-Iraq war and afterwards, they had sponsored the opposition to Saddam Hussein. They had used the Shia anger at Saddam Hussein and his brutality against the Shia to gain support inside Iraq for their Shia religion and for their Persian aspirations. And so when we went in there as the occupying power, they quickly armed Shia militia. They equipped them with weaponry, and the Shia militia fought at Iran's direction against the United States presence. Even though we were in there trying to help the Shia wouldn't accept it. They wanted to fight against the United States because Iran told them to do so. So we're in a long-term power struggle that Iran wants us out of the region, at least out of their way in the region, so they can own the space, dominate the region, and ultimately, of course, they'd like to prove that their sect of Islam is the true sect of Islam.
Well, I could appreciate your opinion as a military expert. This is your training. This is what you have been doing all of your life, all of your professional life. So I understand that. I'm asking, as a person, I mean, you were a former commander of NATO. You spent all of your professional years in the military accomplishing essentially the orders given. You get a set of orders and your job is to execute them. At what point does the military begin to raise questions about the conduct of the administration, the commander-in-chief, as to whether the objectives really fall in line with what the military is there for? The military is there, as I understand it may be a simplistic understanding, but the military is there for defense. But what you've been outlining, you talk, for example, about taking out Saddam Hussein. He just happens to be the president of a country and a person supported and brought into leadership by the United States. And then, of course, things went sour, and there was a matter of, quote, neutralizing him. I'm asking, essentially, at your level, where you are the person, and like many others at the level that you operated in the military, You are there to effect certain commands, to get certain things done. Is there some kind of body or authority within the military that says, well, wait a minute, we're not behaving right. We're not doing the right thing here. This is not what the military is for.
Well, first of all, the advice I gave you wasn't military advice. It was advice based on reflection on U.S. policy.
Correct.
I've had a very broad career. I've worked in the White House in the Ford administration and the Office of Management and Budget. I was in NATO under General Alexander Haig. I studied at Oxford. I have a master's degree in politics, philosophy, and economics. I taught economics at West Point. I've been 15 years in the business sector. I ran for president. I do international business. I talk to world leaders all over. So please, what I said, don't say it's military. It's not military. It's sound advice from one person who's been lucky enough to be at the top levels of the military, politics, and business over the last 20-odd years.
So what I was getting at, I'm not suggesting at all that you were giving advice. What I was getting at was a question, a philosophical question about is there... Because we land in this situation all the time, in which the United States is seen as an aggressor, seen as coming into a situation in an aggressive mode. And it's not the only one. Russia does it, China does it, the big leaders do it.
Don't ask for people in uniform to give you the opinion I gave you. I couldn't give you that opinion in uniform. For one thing, I didn't know enough. And for another thing is when you have your uniform on and you're in service of the United States of America, you take the orders of the commander-in-chief. Now, when their policy is being studied and people are proposing options, the top leadership of the armed forces through the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they have their right to express their opinion and give their views. As General Colin Powell used to say it in the Bush administration, he'd say, just tell us what you want to do, and we'll tell you if we can do it and how much it costs, what the risks are. Or as we used to formulate it in the Clinton administration, we would participate in the formulation of courses of action. And we would say what was feasible and what wasn't feasible from a military point of view. But you don't really have the big picture that the president and his team have. You're just a military person. You're just part of the situation. And so you have to have a little bit of humility about yourself. Now, any officer or soldier in the military can refuse to obey and should refuse to obey an illegal order. So if the order is against the law, whether it's an order by your sergeant, your civilians, or an order by your president to attack another nation, you have an obligation to refuse it if it's illegal. But in the case of the war in Iraq, there was nothing illegal about that. It was passed by the United States Congress. It was authorized. There was even a UN Security Council authorization to do this. So there was nothing whatsoever illegal that any officer on duty could have seized and said, Mr. President, you're ordering me. Now, as a matter of conscience, you can always say, no, I don't want to do that. I'd like to resign. Here's my commission. And maybe you'll get to resign. But to simply take the armed forces as an instrument of policy, walk up to the President of the United States, say, well, what you're doing is perfectly legal, but we think it's an unwise move. No, you have your chance to offer that opinion if you're the top person in uniform and you're the advisor to the President and the Congress, like the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But otherwise, you do your duty. That's what you are in uniform to do.
I appreciate that. But I come back to the question, at some point, at different levels, people have enough elastic to ponder these things. Do you get a sense that the U.S. administration, the Obama administration, and the Bush administration before that, that initiated the incursion into Iraq, do you get a sense that these kinds of discussions were amply explored before a decision was made? And secondly, do you get a sense that the Obama administration has a cogent foreign policy in the region?
Well, in the Bush administration, the record shows that searching questions weren't adequately explored. That's why we ended up in Iraq with no plan. As far as the Obama administration is concerned, they've researched the questions and gone through these issues in great depth. However, they're in a position where it's very difficult to put together a coherent strategy. And on the one hand, our allies have provided a lot of funding and weaponry to a group of terrorists who are using terrorism as a tactic. And it turns out that they have Baathist leaders, and it turns out that our own allies are encouraging these people from ISIS, or who became ISIS. It was like creating a Frankenstein in a laboratory. Sure, that Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey didn't mean to do this, but it happened anyway. And that's who they are. They're Sunni terrorists. And on the other hand, what you have is you have a bitterly anti-American government in Iran, supported by a superpower, Russia. So this is a tough position to be in. And the administration's done the best it could do to try to square the circle here and have some coherence out of the policy. It didn't actually work very well because it turns out that when you train a bunch of people and put them in and you come to fight, and they say, well, what am I fighting for? They say, well, you can only fight ISIS, but you can't fight Bashar Assad. And they say, well, we want to fight Bashar Assad, too, because he's the one destroying our country. So they can't do that. Then that doesn't work. So that side of the policy didn't work. The side of the CIA training 5,000 fighters, yeah, that worked. They're in there, and they're being attacked today by Russian aircraft and by Russian-supported Syrian and perhaps Iranian forces. So the question for the United States is, do we defend these people that we put in there, or do we, you know, let Vladimir Putin get away with it? If we defend them, then we risk a confrontation with Russia. He moved into our space. If we don't defend them, then you have to presume that they may not exist a few weeks from now. They'll be pushed out of the region. And so it's Vladimir Putin's game. If you play it the way the president said, you say, don't worry about it. The big picture is Putin's weak and he's going to lose. Maybe so. Maybe you can take the long view. But it doesn't seem coherent. It's a strategy, but it's not a leadership, because our European allies are looking for leadership, not necessarily forces. They're looking for guidance on what to do. They're looking for help in handling this wave of refugees that's coming in there. And for the United States to say, don't worry about it, we'll take 10,000. Germany's looking at 1.5 million. So in a population less than about one-fourth the size of the United States. So there's some disparity here, and there's some concern on the part of our European allies. They're asking, is America still there for us? And I hope we will be there for them, because it's very important. Through NATO, we've provided the architecture for global security and economic progress for 70 years. We don't want to surrender that because Vladimir Putin's landed a few airplanes and a few anti-aircraft missiles in Syria.
Well, some people would say that it's not just security, but it's also hegemony. And it is, again, it divides the world in two. And as the African proverb says, when two elephants fight, it's the grass that loses. When we had the Obama administration deciding that it was within U.S. authority to essentially invade a sovereign nation, whatever the opinion is about the leader of the nation is set aside. The fact is, he was elected and he was the leader of the nation. I'm referring to Bashar al-Assad. And they were going to invade, essentially, Syria in hot pursuit of ISIS. And that was a very interesting and ticklish position to take, don't you think?
Yes, all these issues of hot pursuit are always difficult. But what you end up with is that although the territory may have been legally within Syria, the territory was not under the effective control of the Syrian government. It was under the control of ISIS. And so for the United States to bomb ISIS, there's nothing the Syrian government can do or say to help the United States get rid of ISIS. In fact, the Syrian government's tactic was the opposite. The Syrian government actually went after the non-ISIS resistance, because the way it works is the more extreme your resistance, then the greater the likelihood that people will fall back on you after all, because you've taken away all the so-called moderate alternatives. And that's precisely what Bashar Assad was attempting to do. He was attempting to take away all of the moderate alternatives. And so the United States was left in response to world opinion, in response to an emerging threat, not only to Americans in the region, but to our allies. Yes, we went after ISIS.
But still,
it wasn't against international law. It's under the right of self-defense.
But the United States, just the same, within a sovereign nation, is actually arming rebels intent on achieving what the United States has explicitly said it wants to achieve, which is, as it was said openly, to take Assad out. Now, that should bother a military man.
Well, actually, the United States had two different programs. One program was explicitly, and the bombing was explicitly directed against ISIS. And although the president called politically, said Assad doesn't have any legitimacy to rule his people, in actual fact, the only effort that was made was a CIA effort to train a few people and provide some moderate funding to the political opposition. The United States did not instigate the conflict with his people, and it did not lead the conflict with the Syrians' resistance. So we were drawn into it in a pursuit of regional stability, in essence, and in trying to eliminate or help people eliminate a guy who was attacking his own people and causing the refugee flow.
There's international law here. The international law says, as I understand it, you can't do that. You can't.
No, the international law doesn't say that.
You can't arm people within a sovereign nation, and you know, even though you share their view that the head of state is supposed to go, meaning assassinated, killed, driven out, whatever way, and then you continue to arm them, which is to say, I mean, I would ask you, if the tables were turned, some foreign government armed a group of people in the United States and said, okay, we don't like your president, and you don't like him either, so we are going to fund you so that you can take him out. What do you think is likely to be the response on the part of that government?
Well, the truth is that this is one of these areas that is inadequately covered in international law. And so under national law, the United States operated in accordance, I assume, with the authorization approved by the United States Congress for the Syrian opposition. And that was the that was totally legal within the United States system.
So, right, but the United States does not have authority over foreign sovereign states. It seems to be the United States, the fate of a foreign government cannot be decided by Congress. Congress also decided on the invasion of Iraq, and you admitted it was the wrong decision.
Yes, but admitting a decision is wrong, not admitting it, I ran for president, madam, because I believed it was a mistake. I didn't admit it was wrong. I asserted it was wrong from the beginning. I questioned it, and I'm calling it wrong. But that's different than saying the United States doesn't, in protecting its own interest, have the right to intervene in other states. The United States and other nations do this and have done this repeatedly. Yes. There may be some wrinkles in international law that could justify it. Under the United Nations Charter, nations have the right to self-defense. And here you had people attacking Americans. That's what ISIS was doing. And they beheaded Americans. And the United States took action. And under international law, you do have the right to self-defense. So we pursue terrorists all over the world. We're not going to give another Osama bin Laden the chance to, in impunity, set up this terrorist organization and wait till he strikes us before we go back and take him out.
But you also have a solid history here, too, of the United States creating terrorists, arming terrorists, funding terrorists, giving material and other support to terrorists.
That's why it's... That's why it doesn't look coherent. And that's obviously what has bothered the Obama administration. That's why the policy has stalled, because we're bothered by that. It's like one person in the region said, who do you think is going to fight these Hezbollah extremists? Nobody but Sunni extremists.
Well, now we have this engagement Within Syria, which now is further complicated by the face-off or face-down between Russia and the United States and a bunch of other groups in between, what is likely to happen? Is this tension between the United States and Russia likely to escalate, and what would stop it?
Well, what would stop the tension from escalating is a strong response by the United States that would halt Putin from the escalation. That's what would stop it.
But why? But Vladimir Putin is doing what he's doing at the request of the head of the sovereign state, Syria.
Vladimir Putin attacked a sovereign state in Ukraine. He has used Bashar Assad as an opportunity to reinstall Russian power in the Middle East, as well as to sell weapons and make profits. He's got a major geostrategic play underway. And yes, it may be true that Bashar Assad said that he was the guy who invited him in. But ask yourself this. Was Bashar Assad a legitimately elected ruler of Syria?
One could ask the question, was George Bush a legitimately elected ruler of the United States?
What's Bashar Assad's mandate? Who gave him the authority and put him in power? The answer is, he's maintained power by force. And the United States has in the past dealt with him as the de facto head of the government and eventually just said he's okay, he's de jure. But the truth is that there's no accepted process that I'm aware of that put Bashar Assad in power. He's there.
Why is it why is the democratic will of the people in this dismissed? Whether people like Assad or they don't like Assad, the fact is elections were held, he was elected. I understand as great
kind of elections
bitterness
were they? You think they were free and fair elections?
But we are not the arbiter of that. More than people are the arbiters of elections held here in the United States for Congress and all kinds of office.
Look,
so my point is...
You know basically what the issue is with international law, and all of your discussion goes back to international law. Of course, I'm a big believer in international law, and I helped arrest Serb war criminals, and I testified against Slobodan Milosevic in the International Criminal Tribunal on Yugoslavia. So I'm all in favor of international law. But international law has one problem. It has no sovereign. There is no final arbiter of international law. We tried very hard to get a UN Security Council resolution to halt the slaughter in Syria, and it's been repeatedly blocked by Vladimir Putin and by China, I might add. So when legal resolution is blocked, what alternatives remain for nations?
Well, this is the question that I asked you in a different way, except that nobody's hands here are clean, not Russia, not China, not the United States. People would say every time a situation comes up, an issue comes up in the UN Security Council, the United States always vetoes a bill or a motion an effort brought by other nations and endorsed by China or Russia. We get that all the time. So, again, it's that proverb, when the elephants fight, is the grass that loses. What has to happen, is my question, for these superpowers to stop this business of constantly using other people's countries to wage wars of whatever type and for whatever reason for their own benefit?
Well, I think you're asking a very profound and very important question. but I don't think there's any answer to it short of divine intervention. There is no sovereign power on earth that can substitute for the power of the nation state at this point.
So if you were to take a little bit of a long view here, where does U.S. foreign policy objective, where does the U.S. foreign policy objective lie? What is foreign policy for, especially when it is linked to military action and outcome?
It's to protect the freedom and security of the people of the United States.
And in this process, since the people do not determine foreign policy, the people who vote for president don't determine foreign policy, the people who vote for Congress members and members of the U.S. Senate don't determine foreign policy, since this is an arena that is off limits to the average American, what systems do you think ought to exist as a form of checks and balances so that we don't get people making these kinds of decisions or refusing to make good decisions that in the end will cost some mother and father their son and daughter's life?
Well, there's nothing better that I know of than holding our elected leaders accountable in the democratic process. And that's what elections are all about.
Do you have any hope at all that we would see in the immediate future, especially with regard to Syria and the Middle East as a whole, that we would have in the United States a cogent, transparent foreign policy objective there?
Well, I think the foreign policy objective is pretty clear in Syria. What the president has said is he wants Bashar Assad out of power. Question is, how do we implement such an objective? How do we do it with minimal cost to the United States, with minimal violence in the region, and with the due protection of our friends and allies around the world? How do we do that? And that is the issue.
Well, you know, what you just said there is so scary, because what if the president were to wake up tomorrow and say, you know what, I don't like the Prime Minister of England. Let's take him out. I don't like the Queen of Norway. Let's take her out. I don't like the Prime Minister of Trinidad. Let's take him out. Simply because the president says it and has the military might to effect that, make that decision real. Who is in charge of saying no? This
well,
can't,
that's why
this,
we have the War Powers Resolution.
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
The president is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. You're asking questions, madam, that are embedded in the Constitution. I'm not a constitutional lawyer. I know what I've learned in life and what I learned from the military. But these are questions that are embedded in the Constitution. So, I mean, you need to get someone on the line with you who can appropriately tell you all about the U.S. Constitution. Here's what I know. The president's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, and he has the right to order those armed forces into action. The Congress has a right to declare war. And the president has, under the War Powers Resolution, a certain amount of time in which he can commit the armed forces before he has to account to it in front of the Congress acting on behalf of the American people. It's really about that simple.
I want to thank you, General Clark, for being with us today and for giving us your perspective. Very, very enlightening indeed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that was retired U.S. Army General Wesley Clark, who also was the Supreme Allied Commander and Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. European Command under NATO. And he was talking, and I thought I would ask to get a sense of what is the orientation. We know we have expectations about what the government ought to do, what the thinking ought to be like, but it's another thing to come up against what the thinking actually is. And I thought it was valuable to listen to how military people think and what obtains in their world, how things are done, how decisions are made, what's your job. And for the military, their job is to just go get the thing done. So when we talk about these military incursions and wars and so forth, the most important thing to keep in mind is that we, you and I, we the people, have no role whatsoever in any of this. We don't get to do anything to forestall a decision or to change a decision or to in any way impact a decision. Our voices, however, can be heard prior to decisions if only we know that decisions are going to be made. But then we find these things are done when we hear it on television that this is in progress in our names. Such and such a bombing is occurring in our name. Did we vote for that? Did we okay that? Is it something we consider the right or moral thing to do? That's not what is important in their world at all. So today, although these are two entirely different subjects, what draws them together, what binds them together for us, is that we, the people, very often have no clue about the real agendas that are occurring and in which we have no say, but which are predicated on our participation. Thanks for joining me today. That brings us to the end of the program. I hope it was useful. And I apologize again. We had some transmission problems between General Clark and us because he was traveling. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. And tomorrow, you know, it's Free Your Mind Friday. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.